Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Well, yesterday was an absolutely awful day for Donald Trump, and today is shaping up to be even worse with the release just a little while ago of the text of the whistleblower complaint. And we are joined by Quinta Jurassic, managing editor of Lawfare Blog. How are you?
I am tired, I would say. It has been a long couple of days.
It is amazing. And I said to you right before we started this, I want to avoid the cliche, but I'm going to fail, that it does feel like we're drinking from a fire hose here. But I did notice last night, I'm lying in bed. It was way past my bedtime, and I see your tweet that you were afraid to go to bed because something would happen. And I said, whoa.
Yeah, and you know, right after I tweeted that, a Republican representative tweeted that the whistleblower complaint had been declassified. And so I thought, you know, oh God, who knows what's coming next? Although, of course, it turned out that it was then released this morning rather than last night.
Well, the last 3 years, we've had these insane news cycles, but the last 48 hours has really been extraordinary, with the dam breaking and impeachment becoming all but a complete certainty, the release of that phone call yesterday. And I guess we've almost become, expect that we're going to be let down, that it's going to not live up to the expectations. And then we read the readout, or whatever you want to call the non-transcript transcript of that phone call, and it turns out to be way worse than anybody expected. And then as the day played out, you realize that there were more shoes to drop, and here we have this whistleblower complaint. Let me just read you the lead from the Washington Post. And again, we're doing this pretty much in real time this morning. House Intelligence Committee has released the whistleblower complaint at the heart of the burgeoning controversy over President Trump's July phone call with the Ukrainian president, an explosive document which claims not only that the president misused his office for personal gain, but that unidentified White House officials tried to hide that fact. So we're now seeing the word cover-up. There's a direct quote here. In the course of my official duties, I have received information from multiple U.S. government officials that the president of the United States is using the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country in the 2020 U.S. election. This interference includes, among other things, pressuring a foreign country to investigate one of the president's main domestic political rivals. The president's personal lawyer, Mr. Rudolph Giuliani, is a central figure in this effort. Attorney General Barr appears to be involved as well. Okay, so wow, where do we start? So, Quinta, what jumps out at you? What are your initial takes from reading this complaint?
Right. So I think I was really interested to see what was going to be in the complaint, in a large part because after members of the House Intelligence Committee saw it yesterday, a lot of them sort of went and gave statements to reporters, both Democrats and Republicans, saying, you know, this is really troubling. This is really, really bad. And of course, by that point, we had already seen the transcript of the phone call. So I was sort of wondering, you know, what could possibly be worse? But it really is, you know, as initial news reports indicated, it really is a question not only of the phone call with President Zelensky itself, but of the broader pattern of conduct surrounding that phone call, specifically that, you know, this was a long-running interest of President Trump's and of his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani's, sort of using Ukraine to manufacture, dig up dirt on Joe Biden, that took place over many months. And second, that people within the White House appear to have really tried to cover it up by essentially classifying records of this call in a way that they shouldn't have been classified. One of the parts of the complaint that I found the most disturbing, actually, is this hint that this is not the only call that has been sort of squirreled away in a way that it shouldn't have been, that there are other conversations between President Trump and foreign leaders that have been handled this way. And as of now, we don't know what those matters may be.
This is directly from the complaint. In the days following this phone call, this would be the phone call with the Ukrainian president, I learned from multiple U.S. officials that senior White House officials had intervened to lock down all records of the phone call, especially the word-for-word transcript of the call that was produced, as is customary, by the White House Situation Room. The set of actions underscored to me that White House officials understood the gravity of what had transpired in the call. And that seems to be the main takeaway. Now, there is a possible more innocent explanation for all of this, which is, if we recall, early in the Trump presidency, he was embarrassed by the leak of some of his conversations with foreign leaders, including, I believe, the president of the Philippines. And it may have just have been, look, I don't trust people around me. I want to lock down these conversations so they don't get leaked again. So there may be a pattern that is not specific to this Ukrainian story, but it certainly looks bad, doesn't it?
Yes. I guess I suppose that what you point out is possible, but it really does look very, very bad.
What's interesting about all of this is that it does back up a lot of the reporting that we've received in recent days about what the concern was and the pattern of the behavior. The Washington Post had this story yesterday about Rudy Giuliani's efforts and the way that he was circumventing much of the national security apparatus. So, unfortunately, we live in an age in which, people go, well, what's new? Is there anything new there? I think part of it is the accumulation of evidence to realize the recklessness of this president, and that after spending 3 years talking about whether or not there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, that we now have in broad daylight evidence that here is a president that wanted to collude with a foreign government to dig up dirt on his opponent. I mean, it is kind of gobsmacking. And I think maybe part of the problem is realizing that, wait, we actually have all of this. There is the smoking gun here. There was, if not an explicit quid pro quo, I think David French makes the great case, that he says, and I'm sure you've seen his piece, as a trial lawyer, that if he couldn't prove to a jury and a judge that conversation involved a quid pro quo, you want the weapons, but I need a favor from you, though. Then he would have to hang up his shingle. So, I mean, it is, I think, difficult to sometimes get your head around the fact that we have all this now.
Yeah, it is very striking that apparently this phone call, took place immediately after Robert Mueller's testimony to Congress. And that it seems like, Trump was kind of punchy. He was feeling like I don't think it's too far to say he'd gotten away with it, right? It really seemed like the Mueller had put forward these conclusions that were incredibly damning, at least on the matter of obstruction, and I would argue on the matter of cooperation with the Russian government during the 2016 presidential campaign as well. And Trump sort of felt that he wasn't going to face any real consequences from it, and sort of hops on the phone with Zelensky and makes this weighted demand for a favor. the news cycle has reminded me these past few weeks of the news cycle in May 2017 when Comey was first fired. Where just, if you recall, there was a new insane story every day. The pace just felt incredibly frenetic. And then what happened was that Mueller was appointed and, news still came out, but the pace started to slow a little bit and Congress never really took action. There was hemming and hawing every time there was a new piece of information released. And sort of over the course of 2 years, there was this kind of drip, drip of negative information, but at no point perhaps did we recapture that initial energy, although I would argue, the material that Mueller uncovered was extremely bad. And so what's funny is that Trump seems to have basically looked at that and concluded that he can get away with anything. And so the Ukraine story is sort of the Russia story on steroids, in a way, with all of the mitigating material deleted. It is a direct conversation by President Trump to another foreign leader. There is zero ambiguity about whether he knew about it because he's released this memo. Now, you know, he's admitted to it in public, as has Rudy Giuliani. There's just nothing. There's no doubt.
Well, and also, I'm looking for a tweet. Somebody pointed something out among the stories that tend to get overlooked. The role that the Attorney General Bill Barr played in all of this, the role that the State Department played in all of this, the way the blast radius of this is now spreading to other members of the administration, that in itself is a huge story. That they're going to have to pursue. So, I mean, I'm trying to think of, you know, what other shoes there are to drop, and there seem to be so many, because this whistleblower complaint, and he acknowledges, or he or she acknowledges, that they did not witness a lot of this firsthand. So, there are things that could be subpoenaed. There is more testimony that could be brought out by people who had firsthand information for, you know, from all of this. Rudy Giuliani's holding up his phone on Fox News the other night saying he had all of his communications with the State Department. That seemed to me to be an invitation for someone to subpoena all of that. So what questions, what do you want to see next? What, if you were on the phone with Adam Schiff, or you were on the phone with Nancy Pelosi, and they would say, okay, Quinta, what do we need to hear from? What do we need to learn next about this story?
Right. I think there are a couple things. First off, as I mentioned before, it really does seem to me like the committee should be digging into what those other transcripts are that have been shielded away, potentially to protect the president from embarrassing, damaging disclosures. That's one thing. Another thing is, as you say, the role of Bill Barr. It is not totally clear to me what role Barr actually had in this, as opposed to what role President Trump would have liked him to have had. So throughout the transcript of the call with Zelensky, Trump repeatedly says, I think about four times, you know, not only talk to Giuliani, but talk to Barr, coordinate with Barr. The Justice Department released a statement yesterday saying that Barr had never been told by the White House or by President Trump that he should coordinate with Ukraine. He hadn't talked to Ukraine about any of this, sort of suggesting perhaps that Trump had made that outreach to Zelensky but hadn't followed up with it regarding Barr. On the other hand, the whistleblower complaint does say that Barr seems to be implicated as well. That may just be a reference to the memorandum of the call, but we don't know. And it is very noteworthy that the director of national intelligence, or the acting director of national intelligence, appears to have gone to the Justice Department with this question about how to handle this complaint, and that Barr was not recused. And so Barr's Justice Department is making a decision about how to handle a complaint that implicates him. So I think at the very least, there need to be questions to the Justice Department about simply how this was handled and to what extent Barr was or wasn't in the loop.
Why do you think that the White House released that memorandum yesterday? I'm genuinely puzzled by all of this. I mean, I understand the explanation. They want to get ahead of the story. They knew that it was ugly. Maybe they thought that they could spin it. But why do you think they did it?
I honestly have absolutely no idea. I saw it when I read it yesterday. I could not believe that they would release that information and call it exonerating. I mean, it is so bad. I cannot emphasize that enough. My working theory, and I emphasize that this is really only a theory, is that, I mean, maybe the president really convinced himself that somehow it was exonerating. Maybe the theory is that it's very difficult to spin nothing, and therefore if they gave the president's allies more text to kind of work with, that they could throw more spaghetti at the wall and see what would stick. But it is truly baffling.
Yeah, it is truly baffling. That's why I'm asking, because I think you're right that he convinced himself that there was nothing there. You know, at some level, Donald Trump does not recognize that what he did was wrong, which tells you a lot about Donald Trump. Not something that we did not know, but rather dramatic that he convinced himself that people would look at this and go, yeah, this is nothing, because this is the way his mind works. This is the way he transacts these kinds of conversations, and he apparently, his famous instincts failed him in understanding how this, in fact, would look. Okay, so this is all triggered in the last 48 hours, this massive breaking of the dam, whatever analogy you want to use here, where we now have a majority of members of the House of Representatives in favor of some sort of an impeachment inquiry. This seems like a very, very big deal. I know that you have been in favor of impeachment from the beginning and have been, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but have been very, very frustrated by lack of momentum on all of this. So, you know, as you're sitting watching this, you and others, and I would agree with you, you know, would say that, look, we have had plenty of evidence that the Congress had a constitutional obligation to move ahead with impeachment before this. So what is your reaction after months and months and months of saying, folks, we have the stuff. It's right here. We have all of this evidence of presidential misconduct. Why aren't you doing anything? And then watching it all happen in 48 hours.
It's astonishing, honestly. It really, really is. And it feels like, I will acknowledge that, as you say, yeah, I've Susan Hennessy, Lawfare's executive editor, and I wrote a piece basically immediately after the Mueller report came out, arguing that if the House of Representatives was going to take it seriously, they needed to begin an impeachment inquiry. So, yeah, I've been arguing for this for a while. I will admit, at first, when Nancy Pelosi announced when it seemed like the House was careening toward an impeachment inquiry, I thought, you know, day late and a dollar short, they've let all this go. It's been 4 months, you know, it's the urgency has faded. And then all of a sudden this Ukraine matter drops into our lap and Nancy Pelosi sort of took her foot off the brake and zoomed forward. So, I mean, I will not deny that it is a bit odd that the president has committed, I would argue, an abundance of impeachable offenses over the last 2 years, and that we're now focusing only on this one example, or primarily on this one example. That said, this is really, really bad. So if the House wants to focus its efforts on this, that actually does strike me as reasonable.
Okay, I'm trying to work this out in real time. So this may crash and burn here, because I'm thinking that in many ways this is the opposite of the way the Mueller investigation played out. As you mentioned, the Mueller investigation went dark for a very, very long time. It went for months and months and months. Then when it comes out, it's a 450-page, very, very detailed document. I mean, all the good stuff's there, but people do not read these documents. And of course, then you had the deflating testimony of Bob Mueller. So in a lot of ways, that was the slow walking of a very, very complicated story that was difficult to convey to the public. This, on the other hand, has the immediacy. It is like the fire bell in the night. So it's not a 450-page report. It is a 5-page memorandum. It is a whistleblower account. We don't have Bill Barr putting his spin on it and shaping the narrative. We're getting it raw. And so it feels much more immediate, and it does seem much simpler to explain than the Russia collusion story.
Right. I think so. Without denigrating the importance of the Russia inquiry or the work that Mueller did, in a way, this feels like the second draft. You know, that the reviewers got back the Russia story and said, this is really complicated and we can't figure out what's going on. Can you please just make it a little simpler? And, you know, the writers went back into the writer's room and crafted a version that is much more direct and to the point. I mean, anything that anyone could find ambiguity in the Russia story is just all out in the open.
You folks at Lawfare, I'm looking at the bylines, like every one of you wrote this piece that's up today, self-impeaching, where you say, this time it is different. The misconduct cannot be dismissed as unproven. It screams off the plain text of the White House's own memorandum detailing the president's phone conversation with his Ukrainian counterpart. It cannot be disparaged as the result of a witch hunt. Well, they will. Or blamed on angry Democrats working for a special counsel or attempting a coup from the depths of the deep state. The revelation did not flow from any investigation at all, but instead from the complaints of shock subordinates, complaints that generated pressure that ultimately caused the president himself to fess up and release the document. It cannot be blamed on the squad or on Nancy Pelosi or on Adam Schiff. But by the way, they're going to try to do all of those things. You should read The Federalist more.
I do for my kids.
You should follow Hugh Hewitt and Molly Hemingway on Twitter. So here's the question now. So what now? What should the Democrats do? There appear to be two schools of thought. There are those who think, okay, now you need to hold the hearings, you need to put out the subpoenas, you need to build the case to the American public. You need to dominate television. That's one school of thought. The others is, you have it, go. Strike while the iron is hot. You know, basically call it up, have a debate, move this ahead. Where would you fall down? What would you recommend that they do?
I think strike while the iron is hot, honestly. There has been so much foot dragging on these issues of impeachment that it really just seems to me that Democrats and, you know, and Justin Amash have an opportunity to move full speed ahead here, and really should not waste that opportunity. I mean, there is certainly more information to be gleaned about what precisely happened here, but it does seem to me that the more time they spend dawdling, the more time the president has to try to portray this as, you know, just another example of the Democrats out to get the president, and the more time that, frankly, onlookers and the public have to become inured to what the president has done.
Okay, but you know how this play ends, though. Let's say that they took a vote next month on this, and the president becomes the third president in American history to be impeached. It goes over to Mitch McConnell's Senate, and you know what's going to happen. They're not going to oust him. They may not even hold a trial. And the president will claim that he was found not guilty and exonerated. I'm sorry, but...
Well, that is bleak. So I will say two things. First off, I think that there is a benefit, even if that happens, to the House putting on the record that it is absolutely unacceptable what the president has done here. And I've argued this in the past. I think that that exercise in line drawing is itself a reaffirmation of constitutional meaning rather than sort of succumbing to the nihilism, frankly, that the president has about what the office of the president is supposed to be. Second, I think there is a great value in forcing Republicans in the Senate on the record to defend this conduct. They've been very quiet, by and large, over the last couple of days. Mitt Romney has said that the conduct is troubling. Ben Sasse surprisingly came out of his sort of self-imposed exile to say that it was troubling, which struck me as very interesting. There have been a few defenders like John Cornyn, Lindsey Graham, Josh Hawley, but by and large, the caucus has been quiet. And I really do think there is a value, first off, in the moment, forcing them to be politically accountable for what this president has done. And also, frankly, in the eyes of history, getting them on the record to say, I do not think this conduct is unacceptable. Third, here I'm channeling Susan Hennessy here again. I do wonder whether the material in this complaint and in this memo is so bad that there may actually be more than a snowball's chance in hell of conviction in the Senate. I don't want to stake any money on that.
I would not.
Yes, but yeah. It does strike me that if there were anything that had a chance of picking up some Republicans, this is really it. So it may actually not be, I may not be writing it off entirely as a possibility, though I certainly acknowledge that it is not likely.
You wrote yesterday, you and I'm going to make sure that I have all the bylines, because you have lots of bylines here, that Benjamin Wittes and Susan Hennessy wrote that Congress should focus on five discrete areas and avoid the temptation to, go off into policy areas. And the five areas you highlighted were obstruction of justice, abuse of law enforcement, Trump's attempts to leverage the power of the presidency to cause the investigation and prosecution of political opponents, Trump's abuse of foreign policy authorities and misuse of congressionally appropriated money to induce a foreign head of state to violate civil liberties of U.S. person. This would, of course, be Ukraine. Number four would be Trump's efforts to obstruct or impede congressional investigations. Number five, Trump's lying to the American public, which I really found interesting, and because you remind us that in 1974, the articles of impeachment against Nixon on his obstruction of justice also noted his lies to the public about the Watergate investigation. And the Judiciary Committee charged that he made false or misleading public statements for the purpose of deceiving the people of the United States. I guess I would have, my only disagreement with that would be that I would have certainly added that if they're going to go for more than just Ukraine, that they ought to go into the attempts to use his office to enrich himself and his family, because voters understand old-fashioned pocket-lining graft. And that's a target-rich environment. But if you're on taking the position now that you think that they should strike while the iron is hot, are you still thinking they should go for those five areas, or should they just simply focus on this Ukrainian issue?
Right. So there has been some reporting that Democrats are sort of weighing how narrowly to focus, and some reports that Speaker Pelosi wants to focus solely on Ukraine. I do think that Ukraine is a crucial, even central component of any articles of impeachment that the House Judiciary Committee should draw up. But I will stick with what I wrote there with Ben and Susan in saying that I don't think it's the only thing, right? His conduct regarding Ukraine is part of a broader pattern of abuse of office, efforts to leverage the presidency to benefit himself and to harm his enemies. And it's for that reason that we incorporated general obstruction of justice and abuse of law enforcement institutions and personnel. So while I don't think that everything should be included, it does seem to me that narrowly focusing on Ukraine seems to kind of draw the keyhole a little too tightly, that it's better to use the Ukraine story as a window onto which to understand the rest of Trump's presidency.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that they are not, they're not limited to the four corners of the Mueller investigation, but I happen to be one of those who believe that there was more than sufficient evidence within that report to move ahead, particularly in the area of obstruction of justice. And then you folks at the Lawfare did that amazing the amazing podcast. Is it all done? You're still releasing
elements. It's still coming out. Hopefully we should actually have another episode up tomorrow. So we're now on to volume two, obstruction, which now seems very apropos.
Well, it does seem apropos. In fact, to a certain extent, this doesn't just simply, move past Mueller, but it also puts everything in that report, I think, in a different light. Because now that we've actually seen how the president interacts with a foreign country and his willingness to ask a foreign country to dig up dirt, and the more we've learned about his particular style of governing, the more credible, I think, many of the elements of the Mueller report get. I do think it's extraordinary how the conservative media continues to think that somehow the Mueller report exonerates him from any sort of charge that there was collusion with Russia, because it documents the I don't want to relitigate this all right now, but it would be certainly a shame to simply just not include that in the impeachment. I don't know whether you had a chance to read any of the stories about probably the most insane element of that phone call yesterday that is actually kind of hard to understand. Trump's reference to CrowdStrike
Oh boy, yes.
You know what I'm talking about? Tim Miller has a piece up in the Bulwark. I know the Daily Beast has a piece as well. And it's so strange. You read it and you go, what is he actually even talking about? I mean, he's in the course of this conversation, because I think this is relevant as well. He said, I would like you to do us a favor because the country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people. The server, they say Ukraine has it. I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but this is batshit crazy stuff. I mean,
it's insane.
Yeah. I mean, this is basically him peddling this weird conspiracy theory that the DNC server hack was actually an inside job. The Russians didn't really interfere in the 2016 election. He's basically asking on this call for the Ukrainian president to look into an American company with a non-existent Ukrainian CEO to verify a conspiracy theory that has been debunked by everyone, including all of the intelligence agencies and the Department of Justice, which would apparently this thing would reveal the Russians didn't actually do it. The leaked emails came from this mid-level staffer who was then murdered by the Clintons. And this is one of those moments you step back and go, what is going on inside Donald Trump's head? What is he reading? This is a man who has access to the best intelligence in the world, right? And he is picking up stuff from the sketchiest corners of the fever swamp. And this is actually driving his communications with foreign countries. I mean, that's not an impeachable offense. I mean, just to be like crazy, is it? I mean, it's just, but it's a reminder.
It is an interesting question whether that is an impeachable offense. I don't know if I would say so. But yeah, I mean, this is, look, I consider myself to be fairly literate in some of the conspiracy theories that have cropped up around the Russia investigation. I will confess that I actually had to go back and read up on this one.
Oh, I did too. No, I did too.
Because I was familiar with this theory that, you know, the FBI hadn't really examined the server, but the aspect of connecting it to Ukraine, that's a new one, frankly. And it does seem that Trump has made comments in the past indicating that he thinks CrowdStrike is owned by a Ukrainian and located in Ukraine. None of that is true. And it does, you know, there is an argument that when the president spouts these theories, you know, he doesn't really believe them. He's just kind of ginning up his base, right?
Yeah, right.
I think this suggests, at least to me, that on some level, he really does believe it, to the extent that he seems to think Zelensky will be able to help him find, you know, the server. He suggested yesterday as well in a press conference that Hillary Clinton's, you know, 30,000 missing emails might also be located in Ukraine. That there's this sort of mishmash of different conspiracy theories into one. And in this case, for whatever reason, it seems to have landed in Kiev.
Yeah. And to say that that's disturbing is putting it mildly, that he believes this sort of thing, which explains, although if you spend any time at all, which I do not advise, you know, people spending any time in some of the, you know, gateway pundit Breitbart world or listen to conservative talk radio, you realize how easily many of these conspiracy theories are spread and believed these days. And, you know, at the root of all of this, of course, is his complete misunderstanding of what happened in the Ukraine, that he does not seem to understand who the prosecutor was that was fired, what the investigation into Hunter Biden was or was not. He appears to have the timelines completely screwed up, and it doesn't seem to bother him or some of his professional turd polishers. That's a technical term.
Exactly. Right. He really does appear to have been getting his information on this issue straight from the fever swamp. And the complaint released this morning actually includes in a starring role the writing of John Solomon in The Hill.
I know that. Yes. And John Solomon is what?
I mean, he's The Hill bills him as an opinion writer, right? And he's been writing these pieces basically alleging that there was wrongdoing by the Obama administration and by Joe Biden in Ukraine. One of the pieces includes this allegation by the Ukrainian prosecutor general, one of several Ukrainian prosecutor generals at issue in this story, who alleged that the Obama administration had warned him off trying to prosecute certain people. The prosecutor general then came back later and said that wasn't true. So it's really
so bad. It really is.
If you look at it as a timeline, and I will shill for the timeline that we've put together on this issue on Lawfare, actually, it really is striking. You can see how this idea kind of moves up from the Hill, percolates through Fox, and eventually reaches the president.
You know, one of the things I mean, I'm glad that we've seen all of this. Although I do think it's an interesting precedent to now be releasing these quote unquote transcripts of conversations between the president and foreign countries. You could tell that President Zelensky was really taken by surprise by the fact that his side of the conversation had been released. He apparently was under the impression that only the Trump portion of the conversation, but that poor bastard has really been kneecapped here. I mean, it's just, you know, that now he's going to have to deal with his damage, the damage control. But going, I see David Jolly is tweeting this morning that that this whole episode ought to raise again the question of those translator notes from the meeting between the meeting between Trump and Vladimir Putin, the private meeting in which afterwards he took away the notes from the translator.
Right, right.
We have no idea. And there was some initial talk of subpoenaing the translator to talk about what had been done. And I will admit that seemed inappropriate to me to do that. On the other hand, you do wonder what happened in that conversation, because it's hard to assume any longer that it was simply benign, and that there's a benign explanation for why Donald Trump was so adamant about keeping what he said to Vladimir Putin and what Putin said to him so secret.
Right, and it really is true that there are plenty of circumstances in which you really would not want to release the White House's conversations with a foreign leader. The problem is that, frankly, we can't trust this president. And some people have written that, you know, releasing this memo would create a really bad precedent, and that it would expose future presidents to the possibility that their conversations would be released, and that would make it more difficult for them to speak candidly with their foreign counterparts. That may well be true, but the sort of paradox of the Trump presidency is that there are so many things he does that are within the mantle of executive power that are nevertheless extreme abuses of that power that his opponents, and in this case himself, are actually willing, and I would argue justified, in tearing down some of that shield. And so in this case, I think it's unambiguously a good thing. Of course, the president made his own decision to release this memo. In the future, you know, we'll see what comes out of that.
Well, Quinton Jurassic, thank you so much for spending so much time with us. We appreciate it very much. You were number one on my list of people to talk to on this rather extraordinary day, and I think it's probably the first of many extraordinary days. So again, thank you, and thank you, all of your colleagues at Lawfare, for the amazing work you guys continue to do.
I'll do that. Thanks so much for having me on.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.